I think most of us don't do too well with change of plans. What do you think? Do you agree with that? There's some of you out there, some of you weird people that are just super flexible all the time. Doesn't matter what happens, you just roll with it. Doesn't shake you in the least. It's like a spiritual gift or something. It's a little weird. I don't have that spiritual gift. Change of plans is something that's hard for me to roll with a lot of the times. And I think most people are like that, you know. And here's the thing, you know this, that's how life works. Like, life is mostly made up of change of plans. That's basically how we live our life. I'm going to plan this, this is on the schedule, this is on the agenda. Wham! Something else comes along and it just destroys it all. You know, change of plans is so frequent. I mean, we might as well just get used to it, but we seem to never get used to it. And it doesn't matter whether it's minor, like, hey, we're going to go out to eat, and we're going to go see this movie, we're going to go and, you know, do this activity or have this date night, you know, as a couple, and then something happens and it changes all those plans. Or maybe it's major and it's like, I have this job lined up, but it fell through and there's a change of plans with my job or with where I'm going to live or where I'm going to go to college. And it doesn't matter whether it's minor or major, it seems to throw us just the same. I mean, just about all of the time, we don't do well with a change of plans. But sometimes a change of plans can be exactly what we need. Like, it can be a really good thing, even if it doesn't seem like it at the time. And often it doesn't seem like it at the time, but we'll look back and we will say, oh, you know what, I'm actually glad that happened. I see how that was a good thing. I didn't like it at the time, but that change of plans was really for my good, and it ended up being the best thing that could have ever happened to me. You've had that experience, right? I'm sure you have. And it reminds me, this whole concept of change of plans and it working out, even though it didn't seem like it. It reminds me of something that Wayne Fisher told me a little while ago. We were talking, and maybe you didn't realize this. I didn't realize this at the time, but Wayne Fisher is actually an artist. He's a really good artist. Amazing. He did a painting for Travis a few months ago. Blew my mind when he showed it to me. Baby Jesus on one panel, and then Jesus on the cross in the next. And it blended together. It was just beautiful. So he's an artist, a painter, and he told me that when he works on a painting, at the beginning, it looks really rough. I mean, it's just terrible. He said it looks bad, it looks chaotic, and so while he's working on it, he's not sure how it's going to turn out until he sees the finished product. And he said, then I get to see how it all came together and all of the mess and all the patience that I had to have as I was working on this painting. It's all worth it because I see the finished product and it's beautiful. And I can look back on all that chaos and disorder and mess and say, oh, okay, now I see. I get it. This is a good thing. Robert is also an artist right down here in the front. And I'm sure he's had that same experience. While you're working on it, it's like, I don't know how this is going to turn out. Right, Robert? And you stick with it, you work on it, and it ends up coming out beautiful. And that's how life often is. That's how life works. And there are several examples of that in the Bible. But one of the best examples of that, in my mind, is the life of Joseph. The life of Joseph. I think he demonstrates beauty out of mess, order out of chaos, and over his whole life story is the statement, the sovereignty of God. It just directs everything. I love the story of Joseph. And Joseph, if you're not familiar with that story, here's a really quick summary of a very long story in life. So buckle up, okay? So Joseph, he was a dreamer. He was a dreamer kind of guy. Had dreams, liked to tell his family what he dreamt. And they didn't really like that. They didn't really like hearing about the dreams. Have you ever gotten in trouble by telling someone what you dreamt? You know, maybe you have, where you had this crazy dream and you told your spouse about it and they were in your dream and it wasn't a good thing. And, you know, and even though you really had no control over what you were dreaming, it still ended up causing you trouble. Well, that was kind of Joseph's experience. He had these dreams about his family bowing down and serving him, so he tells them. And they didn't really take too kindly to that. And his brothers didn't like the fact that Jacob was undeniably partial to him. I mean, he didn't even try to hide the fact that Joseph was his favorite son. He made it very clear. That drove the brothers nuts. And so you got the dreams and telling them, basically, you're going to serve me, even though you're all older than me. He had Jacob obviously having Joseph as his favorite son. And all that was just boiling up to the point where they just couldn't take it anymore. So one day, they see Joseph coming to check up on them. And they say, oh, good, here's this dreamer coming. And so they decide, you know what, we've had enough. Let's just kill him and be done with it. Well, one of the brothers says, no, we can't kill him. Let's not do that. Let's just throw him in this pit, okay? Let's throw him in a pit, this dry well. And his plan the whole time was, I'll come back later and I'll get him out. I mean, he was kind of partially, you know, a little bit of a good guy. But while he was away, the other brothers look up and they see the Ishmaelites coming in a caravan on their way to Egypt, selling their goods. And they say, you know what? Let's make a profit off of this. So they get their brother out of the pit. Rather than freeing him, they sell him to the Ishmaelite traders. They take him to Egypt, and time goes by a little bit, and he becomes the slave of Potiphar, who is the captain of Pharaoh's guard. Pretty important guy. Joseph is placed in charge of his whole household. God was with him, even in his slavery. God was with him. God gave him favor. God was faithful. He was elevated in Potiphar's house to be the kind of like the manager of the household. And he was trustworthy, and he was getting all kinds of good recognition. But Mrs. Potiphar, she started looking at Joseph and decided she would like some of that. And so she tries to seduce Joseph. And Joseph, being a person of integrity and righteousness, he resists her, and he spurns her advances, and he says a really important thing. He doesn't just say, this won't look good for me. He doesn't just say, this will really cause me problems with your husband. He says, how could I possibly do this thing and sin against God? We need to remember that. That's a sermon in itself. Every time we sin, it's a sin against God first and foremost. Anytime we do something that is contrary to his word or his will or his standards, his holiness, it's not just an offense against someone else. That's true. That happens. Like when I sin and it involves someone else, I sin against them. But most importantly, we have to understand any sin we commit is first and foremost a sin against God. And that needs to be something that causes us to refuse it and resist it and reject it. Just the fact that we're sinning against God, that needs to be what keeps us from sin. It's what kept Joseph from sin. He said, how could I do this and sin against God? And then he did another really smart thing. He didn't sit and talk with her through this. Now, let's talk about this. Let's discuss what's happening here. Let's weigh the pros and the cons. No, he got out of there. Like he just ran. He fled. He escaped out of that house and he even left his outer garment there. And she decided that she was going to use that and manipulate the whole situation. And so she accused him of basically molesting her. She accused him to hit her husband Potiphar. And so Potiphar, of course, gets really mad. And rather than trying to determine what really happened, he just believed his wife, and he throws Joseph into prison, into the dungeon. And Joseph is there, wrongly accused, wrongly imprisoned, kind of languishing. And then something else happens, turn of events, kind of another change of plans. And here is the chief cupbearer and the chief baker for Pharaoh. They're both in prison. They get to know Joseph. They have dreams. And they're really perplexed and disturbed by these dreams. They tell Joseph their dreams because God has given him the ability to interpret. And so he says to the cupbearer, he says, good news. what you dreamt means that you're going to be restored to your former position in just a few days. Pharaoh's going to forgive the offense. He's going to realize he overreacted. He's going to put you back in the place of serving him, and everything's going to be great. So when the baker heard that good news, he thought, oh, this worked out pretty good for this guy. I think I might have a good shot. So he tells Joseph his dream, and Joseph interprets it, and he says, well, you will also be released from prison. Good news, yay, for the purpose of being killed. You're going to be released from prison, and then you're going to be executed. Pharaoh will lift you up, but he will basically lift your head up from your body. You know, you're going to be a goner. Sorry about that. Have a good day. And so he says, tell you what, to the cupbearer, because the baker wouldn't be able to really say much of anything being dead soon. He said to the cupbearer, when you are restored to your former position, tell Pharaoh about me. Please intervene, intercede on my behalf. I'm innocent. I shouldn't be here. I've been wrongly imprisoned. I shouldn't even be in Egypt because I was actually sold into slavery by my own brothers. Shouldn't even be here. And I definitely shouldn't be in prison. So please speak to him on my behalf. Well, he forgets. The cupbearer forgets about Joseph until Pharaoh has some really troubling and disturbing dreams, and nobody could help him. And then the cupbearer remembers, oh, wait, there's Joseph. He's just in prison still. He's languishing there. He helped me out. I think he can help Pharaoh out. So he tells Pharaoh about Joseph. They send for Joseph. He comes, and Pharaoh tells him his dreams, and he interprets them, and he tells them that it's a warning from God, that there's going to be a famine unlike anything has ever happened before, unlike any famine, and that if nothing happens to prepare for this, and they don't make really good choices and have some good strategy, then it will wipe out the entire land of Egypt. And so then Pharaoh says, well, what should we do? What would be the answer here? And Joseph to Pharaoh gives him a really good idea. He tells him about collecting all the grain and all the bountiful crops and storing up and saving up so that in the time of the famine, they have more than enough kept back. And so Pharaoh says, you know what? I like this idea. I like this guy. He's a smart guy. Is there anybody else that would be better than him? His advisors are like, I don't think so. No. Mm-mm. And so he elevates Joseph to the second in command, the place of authority over all of Egypt right under Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says, I won't concern myself with anything. You have all the authority, except for the fact that just by the fact that I'm Pharaoh and I'm still sitting on the throne, I'm the only one that's going to be greater than you. But nobody in all of Egypt will be able to lift a hand unless you say so. So he elevates Joseph to this place of prominence and authority and power. And the famine comes, and they follow Joseph's advice. He ends up saving the land of Egypt. But the famine goes beyond Egypt, and it affects the entire region. So back in Joseph's home, where Jacob and his brothers are in the region of Canaan, they also are affected by the famine. And so Jacob says to his brothers, go down to Egypt, because I've heard that they've got more than enough food, and they've got all kinds of grain, and they're letting people buy, and we can save our lives. If not, we're going to die. So they go down to Egypt, where Joseph, their brother, who they thought about killing, threw into a pit, sold into slavery, unbeknownst to them, is alive and is the one in charge of the whole land of Egypt. So they go, and they go before him, and he knows, obviously, that they're his brothers. They don't know that he is their brother. And Joseph decides to have a little fun with this. And we can't really fault Joseph, can we? I mean, come on. He could have done a lot worse. Like, he could have said, these are my brothers. With what they did to me, I have all the power. Off with their heads. I mean, he could have done it right there. He could have thrown them into prison. He could have executed them. Nobody would have said a thing about it. He didn't do that. He decided to, you know, conceal his identity, have a little fun with them, and give them a little test. And so he says, I'll give you grain if you leave your youngest brother here with me. Then you can go back and take all the supplies to your father and your household, and they live. You can bring your father to me, and you can show and prove to me that all you're saying is true and all you're saying is right. If not, if you don't do what I'm saying here, if you don't follow my instructions on this matter, then I'm gonna think you're spies, and you're coming to spy out our weakness, and you won't escape at all. So they grudgingly give in to Joseph's demand, and they go back to their father, and they have to bring their youngest son to them, or his youngest son to Joseph, and prove that everything they said is right. He also hides a cup in the sack of grain, and their money for the grain is hidden there. And so they realize there's the money that we were supposed to buy or pay for all this grain with, and here's this special silver cup that is the ruler's cup. And what are we going to do? This is not good for us. This is going to come out very, very badly for us. And so they come back to Joseph, and he says, "Why would you do this to me? Why would you take the cup of divination that I tell the future with?" All a joke. And he says, "Don't you know that a man like me would know what you've done?" And they say, "We promise we didn't do this. We know how bad this looks for us, but we didn't. We promise." And long story made very short, he has them come to eat with him, and he several times has to leave the room because he can't compose himself anymore. He's just overwhelmed with emotion. He has a really good cry. He washes his face, and he comes back out. He has seated them in order by their age, and they don't understand how he was able to do that. And they then tell him, "All right, look, we did something really bad a long time ago. We had a brother, and he was the favorite of our father." And they tell him the whole thing. "We threw him in a pit. We thought about killing him. We made it look like he was dead. You know, we took his robe that our father made for him. We dipped it in blood, and we made it look like he was killed by a wild animal. And our father was grieving. And we sold him into slavery, and surely he is dead." And then Joseph does another amazing thing. He could have right there said, "Yeah, I know you did all that because I'm the one you did it to, and now you're going to pay." And I think we would probably do that. If we were in Joseph's place, humanly, I think it's a high chance we would have done exactly that. We would have said, "You're right, that's me, I'm still alive, I have all the power, and now you're going to get yours." You know, that's how we probably would think. That's not what he did at all. He said, "I'm Joseph, I'm alive," and then he hugs them, and he kisses them, and he shows forgiveness to them, and mercy, and grace, and he welcomes them. And I mean, they're just stunned, and they're amazed. And he shows this incredible mercy and grace to them that they absolutely don't deserve. It's an incredible turn of events, even for his brothers. And with that all in mind, we're going to segue to Genesis chapter 50, verses 15 through 21. That all led up to what I really want to focus in on as it relates to the "but God" statement as we continue with that focus in this series. Genesis chapter 50, looking at verses 15 through 21. Genesis 50, 15 through 21. So, covered all that ground. Joseph has been revealed to his brothers. They get grace and mercy instead of judgment and wrath. Verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, because he brought Jacob, that's another whole section of the story that I just don't have time to cover. They brought brought Jacob back to Egypt to see Joseph and to settle there, and they set him up with land, and they brought all their people, and so now they're living there in the land of Goshen, which is right outside of Egypt, still part of Egypt's territory. Things are going good. Jacob dies, and so this is what happens. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge and wants to repay us in full for all the harm we did to him?" Yeah, I mean, that's a reasonable expectation, right? That would make sense that he would do that. You know, he spared them while his father was alive out of deference and love to his father, but once his father was dead, all right, vengeance time. I mean, we would understand that. And so they were afraid that was what was going to happen. What if Joseph bears a grudge and wants to repay us in full for all the harm we did to him? Verse 16, so they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father gave these instructions before he died. Tell Joseph this, please forgive the sin of your brothers and the wrong they did when they treated you so badly? Now, please forgive the sin of the servants of the God of your father. So they decided, you know, this would be pretty clever. This is self-preservation here. Let's tell Joseph that his father, our father, said, hey, go easy on your brothers after I'm gone. So they give the person gives that message to Joseph on behalf of the brothers, and it says this: when this message was reported to him, Joseph wept. And he wept because they still didn't believe that he was showing them kindness and grace and mercy and that he truly had forgiven them. So, I mean, it hurt him that they were still thinking that he was going to, you know, lay down the hammer on them. And so it grieved him that they still thought that he was going to do that and be like that. Verse 18, then his brothers also came and threw themselves down before him. They said, here we are your slaves, which is a direct fulfillment of the dreams that he had, because he dreamt that his brothers were bowing down in honor before him. Here we are your slaves. Verse 19, but Joseph answered them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Something we all should remember, by the way, whenever we are wronged, whenever someone does something to us that we don't appreciate, whenever injustice happens and we have the temptation or the opportunity to get even, we need to remember what Joseph said here, and we need to adopt the same mindset. Am I in the place of God? You know, the Bible actually says in the New Testament, in Romans, it says, leave the vengeance business up to God. That's my paraphrase. You know, he says, God says, I will, vengeance is mine, I will repay. So leave it to him. And that's what Joseph is doing. He's saying, am I in the place of God? You know, who am I to decide that you're going to be judged? I'm not God. Am I in the place of God? Verse 20, as for you, this is the main emphasis here in this whole passage that I want to draw your attention to. This right here is the focal point. As for you, you meant to harm me, but God intended it for a good purpose, so he could preserve the lives of many people, as you can see this day. So now don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your little children. Then he consoled them and spoke kindly to them. You meant it for harm, or if you're following along in a different translation, you meant it for evil, but God intended or meant it for good, for the preserving of many lives, the saving of many people. So in other words, Joseph is saying, all that you did, all that you brought about, all that you did that was wrong, and it was wrong, all the evil that you did, and it was very evil, in the midst of that, through that, God took what you did and what you intended to do, and he turned it around, and he used it not just for my good, but for the good of many, many other people. All through what you intended to do. And only God can do that. Only God can do such a thing. And what that shows us and tells us and proclaims and teaches is something that is absolutely just as true for us today as it was for Joseph or anybody else in the Bible, and that is this: God will always make bad circumstances work for our good and his glory. Every time. That is God's track record. He's got a long and perfect track record of doing that. He is faithful to do it. He has promised to always be that way, that he will always make bad circumstances work for our good and his glory. Joseph experienced that. Moses experienced that. All through the Bible, you see people experiencing that. We here today have probably hundreds of stories of that exact same experience. Like if we were to just to sit around and talk about all the times that we have had that happen to us, we would probably be here all day. I'm sure if you've been walking with God at any length of time at all, you have seen how faithful He is in this way. You have seen how you've had horrible circumstances, trying circumstances, things that you didn't know how you were going to get through or get out of, and through it, somehow, God took those bad circumstances and He worked it out for your good and to get glory all at the same time. He took what was happening, whether it was what someone did to you or what Satan did to you, you know, our enemy who's alive and well and loves to trip us up and throw things at us and try to beat us down, whatever it was, whether it was Satan or human or Satan using humans, whatever it was that you have had happen in your life that you just were being beaten down by and discouraged by and you didn't see a way out, God came through and He turned something really bad around and used it for good. You've had that experience, right? I think we all have. Now, here's the thing. God will always make bad circumstances work for our good, but we need to understand that's as He defines good. In other words, that does not mean it's always what we think is good or how we view something being good. It's not good according to our definition of good. It may be that we don't really see it as being good, but He's God, we're not. He's perfect, we're not. He's all-knowing, we're not. He has complete wisdom and is the essence of wisdom, we are not. So that means as a good father, a perfect father, He's going to do things that He knows is ultimately for our good, even if it doesn't feel like it to us. And that's what I mean by He will always work out things for good. It's as He defines good, as He knows what good is. We need to keep that in mind. I definitely have seen this happen in my life, where in the midst of really rough circumstances that I didn't understand what was happening or what the purpose of it was, that not in the immediate, but as time went on, I saw what God had been doing the whole time. One example of this is when I got fired from my job. I was in advertising at the newspaper, the Register Herald, Beckley newspaper, synonymous. I was doing ad copy, you know, selling space for ads in the newspaper. And the guy over that department, my boss, he didn't really like me too much. Pretty much made that very apparent. And to the point where when I was sharing my faith, and this is not just, look at me, how good I am. I was sharing my faith. Aren't I a great Christian? That's not what I'm trying to say. But I was sharing my faith with some of my coworkers, and I mean, they were asking me questions because I was also a part-time youth pastor. And so I would engage them, and I would talk about God and the Bible and the need for salvation. And he, though he claimed to be a believer, absolutely berated me, said, there is no place for that here. This is a place of business. This isn't church. You do that outside of here. You don't talk about that kind of thing. And from that point on, he just kept looking for every possible area to criticize or, write me up for the smallest tiny thing. So I did make a mistake on an ad, pretty big mistake, and he called me into the office, and I walked into the door, and he's doing this, and I'm like, this is not going to be good, and he says, today's the day, and I said, what's that? What day is that? He said, the day where you're gone, and so he fires me, and stood at my desk while I was collecting my things, and he told everybody around me, he said, oh boy, I'm in a fiery mood today. And, just really jazzed the whole thing up. And so I'm walking out of there, and I don't know how I'm going to go home and tell my wife, who we also have a little baby at the time. Aubrey was our firstborn, and we're struggling already just to make ends meet, and now I've lost my job. Long story short, though, as a result of that, indirectly, we ended up moving out of state to Virginia, and I became part of a church staff there. I finished my college degree and had just a tremendous experience of ministry there, great, great years of ministry. Long story short, felt that God was calling us to move back here to do church planting, to plant a new church. The original plan was for me to take over the church, to assume the role of senior pastor, because the pastor was getting older. He had had some health problems. I was already kind of serving as a co-pastor role, and it was just this understanding that I was going to go into the main role and take the primary leadership role. That was all the plan, but then change of plans. God really led us to plan to move back here for the purpose of starting a church. So when I told the leadership that, hey guys, I know we've been thinking that I'm going to step into this role here soon and take over, but God is really leading us in a different way, and it's not immediate. Like, we don't have an exact timetable. This isn't happening tomorrow. I'm just letting you know that within a couple years, we think that we probably will be moving back home to start a church, but we're not ready yet. So we're still here, and we're good to be here for a while until God actually moves us on. Just giving you the heads up. Well, they pretty much pushed me out the door when that happened. They said, oh, well, okay, that's good that God is leading you that way, but if you're not planning on taking over the church for Billy, which was the senior pastor, then we're going to have to find someone who is willing to do that, and we're going to have you go ahead and leave. So much earlier than expected, I was, that door of ministry was closed. But if that didn't happen, we would not have come back to Beckley when we did. We would not have had the time with my mom, who just a little while, relatively speaking, after we got back, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. We would not have had that precious time with her. We would not have had the experience of planting a church, which was a great experience. And if that door hadn't closed, which it did, God really slammed that door shut, I would never have been here. Now, you can determine whether that's a blessing or a curse. That's for you to decide. But that's my story of how many changes of plans led to what I think is a very, very good experience. And that's what God does. He takes bad circumstances, and he works it for our good and for his glory, because every aspect of what I just shared was just all of these opportunities for him to be glorified. The way he provided, the way he moved, the way he opened doors, all of it. It was all him, 100%. And so that's what he does. And when he is glorified, that's when we're truly at our best. When he is glorified in our life. And this is all not just from my own way of looking at things. This is what the Bible actually tells us. Romans 8:28, familiar verse to a lot of you. Romans 8:28, the Apostle Paul says this, and we know, we have certainty, that all things, including bad things, not just the comfortable, easy, good, the hard, the messy, the chaotic, all things work together for good. Remember, as God defines good, for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. That's the promise of Scripture. And that's not just an empty platitude by Paul. That's not just an expression that he threw out there. That was his personal experience. The way I know that is because of what he wrote in Philippians when he was in prison. Philippians chapter 1, verse 12 through 14. Philippians 1, 12 through 14. While he was actually imprisoned in Rome, he wrote this to the Philippians. He said, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that my situation, my imprisonment, has actually turned out to advance the gospel. So my being in prison, my being in this very bad set of circumstances, my being in a less than desirable situation has actually turned out to advance the gospel. And then he goes on about how that happened. Verse 13, the whole imperial guard and everyone else knows that I am in prison for the sake of Christ. In other words, I may be a captive, but I have a captive audience. I have the imperial guard that's you know, guarding me, and I'm able to share the gospel with them. And the implication is that many of even the imperial guard came to faith in Christ. That's the implication. That's what's implied there. They know that I'm in prison for the sake of Christ, and most of the brothers and sisters having confidence in the Lord because of my imprisonment, watch this, now more than ever dare to speak the word fearlessly. So not only am I impacting the imperial guard, I'm impacting my fellow believers in Christ, the brothers and sisters that are around me, and as they see my faith not being shaken, and they see the connection between my imprisonment and yet the freedom that I still have in Christ, even though I'm in chains, and the fact that the gospel is not bound, I'm bound, but the gospel's not bound, that motivates them to go out and share the gospel boldly. This is an evidence of what Paul said in Romans 8:28. All things do work together for good for those that love God and are called according to his purpose, even if that purpose includes bad circumstances. The ultimate example of what we're talking about, the ultimate example of God making bad circumstances work for our good and his glory, is the cross of Christ and all that was accomplished there. Colossians 2, verse 14 and 15. Paul writes this. He has destroyed what was against us, a certificate of indebtedness expressed in decrees opposed to us. He has taken it away by nailing it to the cross, disarming the rulers and authorities. That's the spiritual powers, you know, the evil rulers, Satan and his demons, the demonic host. He's disarmed the rulers and authorities. He has made a public disgrace of them, triumphing over them by the cross. In other words, Satan, you know, definitely motivated the Jewish authorities, and he motivated Judas to betray Jesus to the authorities, and he motivated the Romans, and certainly Satan was at work in all the events that led to Jesus being crucified, but behind the scenes of Satan's work and above and beyond what he was doing, there is a sovereign God who was ordering and orchestrating all of it, every single detail of every event, all to accomplish the purpose for which Christ came, which was to redeem and justify us. And so what Satan saw as his victory, you know, Satan just rubbing his hands like, I got him now, I got him, I got him. What God was actually doing was taking that and turning it around and using it against Satan to do what Paul said here, to disarm the rulers and the authorities and to make a public disgrace of them, triumphing over them by the very thing they thought was being used to defeat Christ. Instead, it caused their defeat and our victory and our freedom. All by the cross. God taking bad and using it for good and his glory. Because of the cross and what Jesus accomplished there, what Joseph said to his brothers, you intended it for harm, you intended it for evil, but God intended it for good and for a good purpose. What Joseph said to them can be applied to our enemy Satan and should be. So every time your enemy throws something at you and causes you to despair and causes you to be discouraged and it causes you to question, where is God? God, I thought you were good. Where are you? Why are you doing this? Why are you allowing this? You can remember what Joseph said and what was true of Joseph, and you can remember that because of Christ and because of the cross, it's true of you as well. And you can say to Satan, and you can say to your own heart and your own discouragement, what is meant here for evil, what is meant for bad, God intends for good, because God is always good. Therefore, whatever God does or allows will ultimately be for our good and for his glory. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the truth of it. I thank you for the power of it. I thank you for the relevance of it. I thank you for the example of Joseph. What an example, not just of his faithfulness, but of your faithfulness. What an example Joseph is of your sovereignty and the fact that you can take really bad circumstances, sometimes unimaginably bad and hard circumstances, and you can use them and turn them around for our good and for your glory. You have a perfect track record of doing that, Father. You're so good at that. Help us to believe that. Help us to remember that. Help us to rest in the fact that you've got this. Whatever it is, you've got this. And you will always work things for our good and for your glory. And there is no greater example of that than the cross of your Son. And so we thank you for the cross. We thank you for the work of your Son on the cross, the defeat of our enemy, the defeat of sin and death, and hope and life and victory for us, freedom for us. Thank you for the cross. We celebrate that. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.